Hello, and welcome to a special membership drive edition of The Film Show on KBOO. I'm SW Conser, and today we are very excited to be joined in the studio by a pioneering documentary filmmaker who has spent the last half century directing his lens on dozens of institutions and communities, from state legislatures and boxing gyms to public hospitals and schools, always allowing the audience to come to their own conclusions. Frederick Wiseman joined such luminaries as the Maisels brothers and Richard Leacock in creating the intimate documentary style known as direct cinema. Direct cinema rejected staged footage and voiceovers, relying on the subjects of the films to tell their own stories. And while we're bringing you this remarkable interview today, we also want to offer you the opportunity to join KBOO and take home some one-of-a-kind thank you gifts when you call toll-free 877-500-KBOO and talk to one of our volunteers. You can get yourself a pair, and we only have the one pair of Star Wars I Love You, I Know posters signed by artist Stephen Poon. We also have a pair of tickets to see Star Wars and More, the music of John Williams at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall. Just one pair of tickets available. So don't wait. Call 877-500-KBOO and become a member of your community radio station. And now, here's my fabulous co-host, Jen Chavez, talking with filmmaker Frederick Wiseman in the studio this past week during his visit to Portland before a special screening of the first documentary he ever produced, 1967's Titty-Cut Follies.
Fred, thanks very much for joining me and welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
So the film you're screening tonight is Titty-Cut Follies, your first major film from 1967. And I wonder if you could start by talking about how you first became familiar with Bridgewater. As I understand it, it wasn't from a filmmaking perspective, but from a legal perspective, right?
Before I started making movies, I went to law school and I taught law for 4 years. And one of the courses I taught was a course in legal medicine. And I took the students on tours of prisons, criminal trials, probation hearings, parole hearings, mental hospitals, to give them, to introduce some reality into the course, because usually the appellate court decisions were very badly written. And I wanted them to see the kind of places their clients may end up in if they didn't represent them properly. And one of the places I took the students to visit was the Bridgewater State Prison for the Criminally Insane. And when I finally had it with teaching law and wanted to make movies, I thought that would be a good subject. And I knew the superintendent of the prison from the visits that I'd made with the students, and he readily agreed. And then it took me a year and a half to get permission from the Commissioner of Correction and other authorities, but I finally did, and I started
Fantastic.
The movie.
Yeah, and I read you filmed there for about a month. Is that right?
The shooting was about a month, yeah.
And then you spent quite a long time on editing afterwards.
Right? Yeah, the shooting was a month, and then it took me about a year to edit it.
Wow.
Because I think for The Follies, I had about 80 hours, which is less than I've had on film subsequently, but still 80 hours reduced to 82 minutes is, you know,
as someone who edited,
quite a wide choice.
As someone who edits radio pieces, I can definitely relate, although I don't know if I've ever had 80 hours of raw footage. At the time, were there any technological developments that enabled you and some of your contemporaries to make the type of movies that you made that were classified later as direct cinema filmmaking?
The invention of a technique that allowed the camera and the tape recorder to run at the same speed at 24 frames a second. Because before that, the camera and the tape recorder had to be connected by a cable. And by eliminating the cable with a crystal control unit in the camera and the tape recorder, you could move around much more easily. I started working a couple of years after that technology was discovered. And what they did was to adapt an already existing camera to that system. That's my understanding of it.
So you've said before that people you film typically don't acknowledge your camera or let it affect their behavior, and that this was true for Titicut Follies. To me, that seems counterintuitive, especially in the context of this movie where prison staff are depicted doing a variety of disturbing things with little to no inhibition. I think of, for example, the way police edit themselves when they're being filmed. So the fact that people weren't more guarded or more self-aware during this situation surprises me. Did that ever surprise you?
Always surprises me, but I mean, you take the example of police, for example, to repeat the word example. I did a movie about the Kansas City police in 1968, just a couple of years after I made The Follies, and there's a scene in that where a policeman strangles a woman who's accused of prostitution in front of the camera. He didn't kill her. He let her go after about 30 seconds. She says to one of the other policemen who's holding her arms, he, referring to the man who was trying to strangle her, was trying to strangle me. And the other cop says, no, he wasn't. You were just imagining it. And yet you, the viewer, have just seen the first cop strangling the woman. Now, you could argue that if we hadn't been present, he would have killed her. I don't think that's the case. I'm not bringing this up as an illustration of police brutality, because there are plenty of other sequences in the film that show police doing useful things, but it is an example of police brutality. But I think that policeman thought it was all right to strangle a woman because she had knocked an undercover policeman down the stairs of the seedy hotel where he'd taken her before he could arrest her. I think what was going on was the police were simply shaping up the woman to the system that existed between the police and prostitutes. And he says to her at one point, don't screw around with our boys. That's not quite the word he used. And if you get busted, you know, we'll take you down to the station house. You'll be photographed and fingerprinted, and you'll pay your $50 fine, and you'll be out in the street in a half an hour. But don't screw around with our boys. So that he choked her or strangled her because he was angry that she had knocked the undercover cop down, and he tumbled down the stairs, and she'd fled to the basement of the hotel. So he thought that was perfectly appropriate behavior for a policeman in a situation where the woman had knocked down or assaulted, you could say, the undercover policeman. And I think I bring that up as an example because I think it's only an extreme illustration of what goes on all the time. We all act in ways that we think are appropriate for the situation that we're in. That policeman thought it was appropriate to choke that woman because of her behavior with another policeman. And he had no sense of the impression that that sequence might create on somebody else, or how somebody else watching that might judge his behavior. And I think that's true of all of us. Although that's just an extreme example. And I think that's one of the reasons I can make the kind of films that I make. Another reason is that I think most of us aren't good enough actors to suddenly change our behavior when our picture is being taken. If we don't want our picture taken, we say no or walk away or thumb our nose. But if we agree to have our picture taken and our voice recorded, we act in normal ways. In the odd chance, the very rare, in my experience, situation where people start to act for the camera, it's almost instantly, you're almost instantly aware of it because their behavior is so different. And in that situation, you're exercising the same judgment that a teacher or a doctor or a lawyer or anybody that deals with a lot of people all the time, an interviewer for a radio station, you know when, for lack of a better term, somebody's trying to bullshit you. And your bullshit meter rises a little bit, And if it happens while you're shooting, you stop shooting. If it, you only realize it till you get to in the editing room. You don't use the sequence. But it happens so infrequently as not to be a problem. That's the only explanation I can think of, because if people acted for the camera, you would think that it would push their behavior toward a bland center. And in making these movies now for a very long time, I've been able to record such a wide diversity of human behavior, from great cruelty, the situation that I just mentioned to you, but also to great kindness and civility. So that's my long answer to the question.
It's great. Thank you. I'm curious about whether, you know, Titicut Follies served in a way as an expose as of the conditions at the hospital. So I'm wondering if you had any intention while making the film of advocating for institutional reform or it being an active advocacy.
Well, I don't think I make advocacy films. You couldn't make a film about Bridgewater, which is where the Follies was made, without showing what a horrible place it was. My principal motive in all the films is to present the place in all its complexity and ambiguity. And I think the Follies, because the prison was such a horrible place, that you couldn't help but conclude that it was a horrible place. But at the same time, the film, I think, deals with other ideas as well. For example, the so-called middle-class helping professionals were incompetent and are shown to be incompetent in the film, the psychiatrists and the social workers. On the other hand, the guards, in their own rough-and-ready way, not always, but very often, were kind and considerate and much more tuned in to the inmates than the so-called middle-class helping professionals. And that the film shows that as well. And you also, I mean, one has to keep in mind that many, not all the inmates, because some were had committed no crimes at all, but many of the inmates had committed some of the worst crimes imaginable. I mean, they had done what we've all done in our worst nightmares in terms of assault, rape, pedophilia, I mean, you name it. Some of them, as I say, had done nothing, but many of them, you know, because of their illness, had done horrible things. And the film really raises the question, despite the violent and antisocial, for lack of a better term, acts that many of the inmates had committed, what is the obligation of the state to provide them with proper services and health care, psychiatric care, a decent place to live? And I think the more general question the film, that's the more general question the film poses. Just when there was a long trial about Titicut Follies, which I won't bore you with, but while the trial was going on, my lawyer had dinner one night with a man who was then the United States Senator from Massachusetts, a Republican senator, and they were discussing the Titicut Follies case. And the senator said to my lawyer, you know, Bridgewater's a horrible place, but the state only has minimum resources available. Would you prefer that those resources be used to create a better place for these people who've committed all these horrible crimes, or would you prefer they go into education? Now, that's an extremely harsh and very conservative view, but it's perfectly legitimate view. It's not a choice that I would make. I would say one tries to find the resources for both. But it's an expression of a political view. And the film, in addition to showing the specifics of life at Bridgewater, tries to suggest these more general questions that are raised by seeing what happens.
Mm-hmm.
Another long answer.
No, it's great. And I'm happy that you brought up, we don't need to go that much further into it, but there was a trial and your film was banned from public release until 1991, correct?
Yeah, 1990, I think. I've forgotten. Yeah.
I found one thing really interesting before moving on, that the issue was the patient's right to dignity and to privacy, but a lawyer who represented an inmate who died there in the 80s said that if it wasn't for the banning of your film, that his patient might still be alive.
Oh, well, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's interesting. You have to send me that link.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was in the late 80s, so I found that paradox kind of interesting of how it benefits or harms inmates.
I mean, one of the things your comments raise is the whole issue of the connection between documentary film and social change. Mm-hmm. And it's very hard to know whether film has any effect or not. I mean, the pompous, presumptuous, self-serving thing is to say that it does. But there's no way you really know that. And in a democratic society, people have access to information from a variety of sources, from movies, from radio station interviews, from other movies, from books, television, magazines, newspapers, etc. There are multiple, you know, to say there are multiple sources of information is a cliche, but it's true. So there's no way of assessing the connection between any one film, movie, play, newspaper expose, radio station program, etc., and social change. And there's both a lot of naivete and a lot of pomposity connected with saying, self-serving statements connected with saying there is. I'm not saying that there's no effect, but I think it's extremely difficult to measure.
Mm-hmm. So beyond the direct effect of your film, societal treatment of those with mental illness has changed a lot following the deinstitutionalization of many facilities like Bridgewater. Now, unfortunately, as a result, we see a lot of people struggling with mental illness living on the streets, unable to access care. My takeaway from Titicut Follies, at least, was that the mental health system of 1967 was broken. First of all, do you agree with that? And second of all, do you think it still is?
You know, I haven't been in a place like Bridgewater since 1966, so I'm in no position to generalize. It certainly was broken at Bridgewater in the trial connected with the Follies. The chief psychiatrist at Bridgewater at the time was asked what books, if any, he'd read in the field. And the only book, and this trial was in 1967, the only psychiatric book he could remember reading was a book by Bloyer on dementia praecox, which had been written in 1918. And he was asked what training he'd had, that qualified him for his job as the chief psychiatrist at Bridgewater, and he said on-the-job training, but he had no residency in psychiatry, and he wasn't board qualified in psychiatry, so you know he didn't know what he was doing,
right.
And I think that someone watching the film and watching the psychiatrists and social workers who were working at Bridgewater at that time in action couldn't help but come away with the conclusion that they were incompetent, mm-hmm. and that in fact there were no really useful psychiatric services being offered. In fact, one of the inmates, a very articulate inmate, in a case conference he basically gives a critique of Bridgewater when he's asked a question by a psychiatric board, and his critique is absolutely accurate.
Well, I want to thank you for your film, and I'm really glad that you are revisiting it. I had one question, something that came up that was interesting to me. I understand that you're working on a ballet or a dance, or you have worked on a dance piece that references to The Cut Follies. Can you talk about that a little
bit? I'm very interested in ballet because I made a movie about the American Ballet Theater. I made a movie about the Paris Opera Ballet. And I made a movie about the Crazy Horse, which is a cabaret in Paris that features dancing. And my boxing gym movie is really a dance movie. So I'm very interested in dance. I also have seen a lot of contemporary ballet. I've always been a bit put off by that so often the subject matter is relationships, whatever that means, man-woman, man-man, woman-woman, or whatever combinations exist. But it's as if nothing else existed in the world. Since I've been making movies about a variety of subjects that involved other kinds of relationships than the ones I described, I thought it would be interesting to try and make a movie about something that was far removed from the usual subject of contemporary ballet. And about the furthest I could get away from it was a prison for the criminally insane. And I thought it would be interesting to see how the movements of mentally ill people could be transformed into classic ballet steps. So there's a choreographer named James Sewell, who has his own company in Minneapolis, and he is choreographing the ballet based on Titty Cut Follies, which is going to have its world premiere in New York at the Skirball Theater at NYU in April 2017.
Fantastic. Well, it's great to hear about it. I've been speaking today with documentary filmmaker Frederick Wiseman. Frederick, thank you very much for joining us on KPBS today.
Well, thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you.
You're listening to The Film Show on KBOO. I'm S.W. Konser with my co-host Jen Chavez. And Jen has been talking with legendary documentary filmmaker Frederick Wiseman. We are currently in the midst of our spring membership drive. So if you've been enjoying the programming this morning, we hope that you'll take a moment to call 877-500-KBOO and become a member. Our phone volunteers can tell you all about the membership options, and we'll tell you more in just a few minutes. But first, let's talk about some of the film-related events coming up in your community. On Thursday, April 28th at 8 p.m., the Northwest Film Center will present the complete first season of The Benefits of Gusbandry. It's a new comedy web series by Portland filmmaker Alicia Rose and co-written with local comedian Courtney Haymeister. More info at nwfilm.org. On April 30th, the Hollywood Theater will host the Columbia River Theater's Organ Society's 2 p.m. screening of The Son of the Sheik. The classic Rudolph Valentino silent film will be accompanied by a live organist. More info at hollywoodtheater.org. May 1st is the opening date for submissions to the 27th version of the Portland, Oregon Women's Film Festival, or POWFEST. Films made in the past 2 years and directed or co-directed by women are welcome. More details on entering, forthcoming, at powfest.com. Running from May 1st through 22nd, the Northwest Film Center will present the series Through Indian Eyes, Native American Cinema, featuring afternoon and evening screenings of nearly a dozen films by First Nation filmmakers, opening with Smoke Signals on May 1st. More info at nwfilm.org. From May 6th through 8th, Film to Buy Bike returns for its 14th annual festival, featuring 59 bike films from 19 different countries with unique programs each night. First two nights at the Hollywood Theater and VIP screenings on Sunday at Northwest Documentary. More info at filmedbybike.org. From May 9th through the 15th, the Hollywood Theater will be home to Northwest Animation Fest 2016. This year's offerings feature 153 animated short films from around the world. The International Shorts program will also screen in Eugene at the Bijou Art Cinemas from May 20th through the 22nd. More info at nwanimationfest.com. On May 12th, KBOO continues our very own film series at the Clinton Street Theater with a 7 p.m. screening of We're From Here, which follows three dancers born and raised in Portland, all with different dance styles and perspectives. More at cstpdx.com. From May 19th through the 22nd, Hollywood Theater will host the 10th anniversary edition of QDoc. It's the only U.S. festival dedicated to LGBT documentaries, and this year will showcase nearly a dozen films. More info at queerdocfest.org. And to close it out with a public service announcement for Prince mourners, here are the theaters playing Purple Rain, the Hollywood Theater, on April 28th and May 2nd, with a screening of Tuareg Purple Rain on the 2nd as well. Laurelhurst Theater, April 29th through May 5th, April 29th through May 1st at Newberg's 99W Drive-In Theater in a double feature with Batman vs. Superman, May 18th and May 20th through the 22nd at the Mission Theater with Friday and Saturday evening sing-along screenings. Rest in peace, Prince. Once again, you're listening to The Film Show on KABU. I'm SW Conser. Thanks to Jen Chavez today for that amazing interview with documentarian Frederick Wiseman. Thanks also to the Oregon Media Production Association for their support and collaboration. And thanks also to our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. The audio for this show, as well as our extended interviews, will be available later today on our archive page, kboo.fm/thefilmshow. And you can keep up with us on Twitter, at KBOO Film Show. Before we go today, we want to make sure that you, the listener, have an opportunity to become a member of KABU today and take home a one-of-a-kind thank you gift that's been set aside especially for fans of The Film Show. And here are my friends, Lynn and Ani, with all the details. Hello, you two. How's it going out there?
Thanks, SW. It's actually going very well. We are well on our way to meeting our $500 goal because folks like Robert from Maupin have been calling in at 877-500-5266 this morning to support independent independent radio, community radio, and a local film show like this. 877-500-5266. And that we have some great thank you gifts this morning, don't we, Ani?
Indeedly, we do. We do have a screen-printed poster by local artist Chad Esley. Chad Esley has done some wonderful artwork for KABU Community Radio in the past. He's a huge KABU supporter, and we love that. We thank him very much for providing an 8.5 by 14-inch screen-printed art. It's a special design created just for KABU by legendary local 2D animator, illustrator, and artist Chad Esley. Again, friend of KABU, why don't you go ahead and join us right now? You can pick up this beautiful poster. It is bright. It is colorful. It is amazing. It's a striking work of art, or as it says here, a striking art object. You can go ahead and call in with your support to KABU. Right now, $5 a month adds up to $60 in the course of a year, and you can say, yes, you want to get this beautiful, really bright, amazing poster by Chad Esley, created for KABU, so you know it's a limited edition, and you would be one of the very few, very proud members to have it. 877-500-5266. 877-500-5266. We do still have a couple copies left of the book, the user's guide as well. Weed, the user's guide, you could still get that, an autographed copy for your $75 pledge. And there's more.
And there's more, I tell you. You can get tickets to the event Star Wars and More, The Music of John Williams. That's Friday, April 29th at 7:30 at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall. A single pair. You can pick up your tickets at KABU. At the office Monday 9 to 5. This is a minimum donation of $180, which ends up being $15 a month if you want to do it
indeed.
That way, which is excellent. Music of Star Wars and More, that's the music of John Williams. We have that. We also, for all you movie nerds, we have a signed Star Wars art, I Love You, I Know You, donated by Stephen Poon, excuse me. Anyway, and for $180 minimum donation, this is an 11 by 17 inch paper laser. Anyway, it's a Star Wars art, and everybody loves Star Wars. It's in the silhouettes of Leia and Han Solo. We've got that. We've got all manner of stuff for you, but first you got to call at 877-500-5266. That's the first step. After that, everything's easy. 877-500-5266.
And I got to say, as first steps go, that one's pretty easy, too. Just go ahead and do it. Do it now. Join KABU, your community radio station. You have been hearing Defiant Attitude. You've been hearing about resistance. You've been hearing about independent art. You've been hearing about weed. You've been hearing about the environment.
What a full morning we have had.
You have been hearing about the plights of urban farming and famine. You have been hearing about oh, so many things, because we know that we live in a complex and complicated world. And we know that there are things that we must decry and fight against. There are things to have a defiant attitude around. And there are times to celebrate and enjoy and rejoice with your community. KBOO gives you a little of all of that. Go ahead and join us. 877-500-5266 or online, kboo.fm. Again, your contribution monthly strengthens us all, and it's an amazing way to support the station. I know I myself give $20 a month. It's a little bit more than an hour's wage. And what I do, why do I do that? Because I know the value of adding my resources up to other folks' resources, because together we are strong. We link arms, we provide solidarity, and we create social change. It's the way it happens, and it happens with your participation. 877-500-5266.
You know, I too do $20 a month, and I do it for all those reasons, and the fact that I got a hoodie from that.
Yeah, okay,
too.
That's really what pushed me over the line. I wanted the hoodie.
I want the hoodie. So if you want the, everybody wants the hoodie. It's great. If you want that, a $20 a month contribution, that's $240 a year. It breaks down so easily that way. And even $20 comes out of your month painlessly and effortlessly. It comes out of your account every month. It's great. You don't have to think about it, and you get a really, really top quality hoodie where you can show the world that you too are a member of KBOO. And it's a great feeling. It's something that you will appreciate. It keeps us going. 877-500-5266.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, your very own community radio station. Take this moment to really, really make it your own. Call us. Become a member right now. 877-500-5266.
Do it.